First Coast Connect with Melissa Ross is sponsored in part by Baptist Health.
The Jacksonville mayor's race is headed to a runoff. Good morning. We're live with you from Studio 2. I'm Melissa Ross, and this is First Coast Connect. Thanks for listening. Just ahead, we'll recap all of last night's races for mayor and city council. You can join us. Give us a call at 549-2937. Then later, a look at some good news for the middle of your week. Yes, it's Wednesday. That and more ahead. But first this hour, we still don't know who the next mayor of Jacksonville is going to be. That's because none of the candidates on the ballot got the 50% plus one percentage that you need to win an election outright. Now, Democrat Donna Deegan and Republican Daniel Davis got the most votes out of the crowded field, so these two candidates will advance to a runoff election in May. We reached out to both campaigns. We did not hear back from the Daniel Davis campaign, but he did have this to say at his watch party last night.
Decisions are being made in Tallahassee and Washington and in our courtrooms across the country that will impact our way of life. And Jacksonville has a clear choice to make leading into the next election. Who will lead our city through these extraordinary challenges and unprecedented opportunities? Will we elect a mayor who will stand with our brave men and women in uniform to make Jacksonville safer? Or we, as Jacksonvillians, go down the pathway of San Francisco and New York? We have to ask ourselves these questions. Will we elect a mayor who will stand with Governor Ron DeSantis to keep Florida free? Or will we embrace the policies of the left that punish hardworking taxpayers? Ask yourself that question. Will we elect a mayor who will stand with the hardworking families and fight for access, for opportunity, for every child and every neighborhood? Or will we give into the low expectations of government knows best? No, we will not.
So that's Daniel Davis from last night, giving us an indication of how he will campaign in the runoff. As I mentioned, we reached out to both of the candidates. Donna Deegan responded, and she is on the line now with more about her campaign. Donna Deegan, good morning.
Good morning, Melissa. How are you?
Doing well. And folks, give us a call as we talk about the mayor's race. It's headed to a runoff, 549-2937. Emails to First Coast Connect at WJCT.org. Lots of tweets coming in already. Tweet me at Melissa and Jax. Donna Deegan, we heard Daniel Davis, your opponent in the May runoff, pledged to run a very conservative campaign, aligning himself with Governor DeSantis' values as he seeks votes to become the city's next mayor. What are your priorities, and how would you govern differently from him? What's the choice?
Well, what I heard I hope you're not hearing that beep. I tried to turn on.
No, we're not.
I tried to silence my notifications. Okay, good.
I don't think so.
Listen, what I heard from Daniel Davis in that sound was basically a lot of wooden, same old talking points that we've been hearing over and over and over again that really have nothing to do with Jacksonville. You know, we have tried to run a campaign very, very Jacksonville-centric in the neighborhoods, talking to folks, listening to their issues, and trying to set forward a positive vision for a city that doesn't just work for a handful of folks, but that works for everybody. And that's something that of course, you hear from every campaign, but what I have asked folks to do in this election is look at who's been walking that walk and look at who just reads off a bunch of talking points, talking the talk. I have been walking that walk for a long time in this city, have been a voice for the voiceless for a very long time. And we're going to continue to take that message to the people. I think what you saw in last night's results is what we've seen for a long time. And that is that a lot of people are with us. We have a strong lead. And I think that we're just going to build on that as we go into the next phase of this campaign.
You were the top vote getter last night, Davis second. That said, more Republicans turned out to vote than Democrats in the election. How will you turn your voters out and perhaps attract some crossover Republican votes What are the biggest priorities you would enact as mayor that you're trying to get out to the voters?
Well, look, I think we have to change the culture of the city. I think that's the biggest message. If you see what the voter turnout was like, and I agree, I mean, 25%, 26% of the folks actually deciding the future of our city is honestly depressing. I would love to see our voter turnout be a whole lot more robust. But I think that's what happens when you see this constant drumbeat of negative attack ads, you know, millions and millions of dollars spent to divide our community. And it really, you know, honestly, Melissa, that stuff is purposeful. That is purposeful to make folks say, why should I bother? Why should I turn out to make my voice heard? This is all just so disconcerting and so negative. What we are going to do is we're going to go and continue to talk to people about a positive vision that will create infrastructure in our neighborhoods that have been left behind. Infrastructure in the downtown and infrastructure in our neighborhoods that have been left behind. We're going to, as I have been talking about in this entire campaign, that three-pillared plan, infrastructure, access to health care, because we have the worst health care outcomes in the state and some of the worst in the country, and it's hard to have a robust economy when you have a lot of sick people. And then the third thing is to bring more people into this economy. We have an economy in this city that has for the longest time worked for a handful of people. We're going to focus very heavily on small and minority businesses to make sure that those folks have the same opportunities that we seem to give to the handful of folks over and over again in this city. And I think a lot of people responded to that. But what we have to do is we have to find a way to get that turnout, as you said, really up in this next election. We got to get people's attention. Hopefully now that it's just two of us and they're not being constantly bombarded with millions of dollars in ads in all directions, maybe we'll get folks to focus in more. And of course, we're going to need a very robust turnout machine. And that's going to be key. That's obvious in this election. We're going to have to focus on turnout.
Now, your opponent, Daniel Davis, has also talked about building the economy, bringing opportunity, improving infrastructure, along with stressing public safety. What would you do differently than him to get to those goals? Because I think what we hear so often from listeners is, how are these candidates going to govern? What would their choices be? How would you go about those goals differently than your opponent?
Well, let's look at how we both run our campaigns. I have run a campaign where I've been in all the neighborhoods, where I've been in every single forum, where I've had an opportunity to touch voters and listen to voters. I have run a campaign where I have been accessible to everybody all the time. What kind of campaign has my opponent run so far? He came to very few forums. He did not stay and talk with the media after our debate. He doesn't do a whole lot of interviews. It's that same old duck and cover that we have seen from these same toxic consultants over and over and over again. And then they just dump millions of dollars into TV ads and think they're going to win a race. Well, I think work ethic beats money, and we're going to find out, right? I mean, if he's asking us to believe he's going to be accountable to the people when he's mayor, and he's not accountable right now. So I don't know how you convince people that you're going to be there and accountable to them when you don't show up when you're campaigning. So how will we do things differently? First of all, I'm going to be a whole lot more transparent than somebody who's basically going to continue the same exact policies as the folks that have been in power here for a long time. A lot more transparency, bringing the people in. We're going to diversify the heck out of our boards in the city so that we make our boards look like Jacksonville. That means a lot of the decision-making folks are going to be different. That means we're going to have a lot more voices in the room than we have right now. We just cannot do something different with the same old that we have had forever. If we want change in this city, if we want to finally break out from, you know, as we've talked a million times, a city of renderings, a city of promises that are never fulfilled, we've got to give different people an opportunity. And like I said, I believe I have shown people in the way that I have conducted my life in the last, gosh, people have known me forever, 40, 50 years in this city, right? That I will do that work. And I think that's a huge difference between the two of us. He's going to keep going in the same direction and tell people to expect a different result. And I'm going to do things entirely differently by bringing people into city government.
Let me repeat, we have invited Daniel Davis to appear on this program, and we hope to hear from him before the May runoff, which is May 16th. We'll go to your calls in a moment at 549-2937. We'll also hear from Jack's Today's A.G. Gankarski in a moment with his thoughts on the race. First, though, I want to ask you about JEA, Donna Deegan. Several weeks ago, Jacksonville City Council member Randy DeFore appeared on this program. She said Davis, the head of the Jack's Chamber, was actually deeply involved behind the scenes in the failed push to sell JEA. That led to indictments and a grand jury investigation. DeFore says this needs to be better highlighted in the mayor's race.
You know, I was on the original SIC committee, and I know a lot about what was going on in terms of Daniel Davis's position. You know, he was very involved in the privatization behind the scenes. I, you know, remember Lenny got up and said, I am not going to put, you know, JEA for sale. Well, that turned out to not be true. His administration was working actively behind the scenes, meeting at the airport with consultants, trying to find a way to actually do that, to privatize the JEA. So, and they were using the chamber, I don't want to say launder money, but to move money in an effort to help to prepare people for this process. They put about $300,000, I think, into the chamber. They also hired lobbyists, you know, things that you would normally have to go through a procurement process and it'd be very transparent. They were using the chamber for. So, you know, there are a lot of dirty hands here. So let's be honest.
That's Randy DeFore. Now, let me also add State Representative Wyman Duggan of Jacksonville, a Republican who has lobbied for Florida Power and Light, the company that tried and failed to take over JEA, is involved with a bill moving in Tallahassee that would increase regulation of many municipal electric utilities in Florida. Among other things, it would say that local governments like the city of Jacksonville shouldn't be able to receive any funds from their locally owned utility. That's the situation we have here in Jacksonville. JEA gives money to the city. Critics of this measure see it as a backdoor way to perhaps reopen the push to privatize JEA once again. And I want to get your thoughts on that, Donna Deegan. Will you bring this up as a campaign issue in this runoff election?
Well, listen, if you believe that Daniel Davis did not want to privatize JEA and would not entertain that option again, then I got some oceanfront property in Arizona to sell you. I mean, Randy is completely right in everything that she said. Look, I have said that I will not run a negative campaign. You're not going to see these grainy black and white, you know, lie-filled ads coming out of my campaign. I did not say that I will not be speaking truth about these issues that have happened. And that is certainly, she is spot on with that. So what we're seeing out of Tallahassee with this issue, I'm glad you brought it up, is a backdoor way to take over our public utility. And who do you think is going to support that between myself and Daniel Davis in the mayor's office? Who do you think will not stand in the way? Who has opened the door to every bit of local control usurpation that we have seen from this governor's office and from Tallahassee at every single turn? Has there been any pushback against a takeaway of local rule? I mean, seriously, Melissa, we are looking at a day when we cannot control our own local government on so many issues because Tallahassee keeps coming in and saying, well, we can't give them an opportunity to take away our power, so we're going to do it ourselves. We cannot have a mayor who's not going to push back against this constant erosion of local rule. And JEA is just one of those issues. So yeah, that will absolutely come up. I hope we have plenty of opportunities to discuss these issues, you know, side by side. I think it would be great for the electorate to be able to hear what Daniel Davis says about all that. But the truth is, we are in a serious battle for the soul of our city right now because we are dealing with a legislature that wants to come in and take away every bit of our ability to rule locally. And we cannot have that. It's in our charter. We need to fight back about that.
549-2937, Hank on the north side. Go ahead, Hank.
Yes, just wanted to encourage Ms. Deegan to reach out to Ms. Cumber on a positive note, you know, about JEA, you know, because that is the truth. He wants to privatize, and you're not being negative, you just stayed in the truth. And I think if you talk to Ms. Culver, whatever her last name is, I forgot, and bring her to a consensus to support you in a positive way without getting dirty toward Mr. Davis, then that'd be a strong, to me, that'd be a strong push toward you. And you could talk to Mr. Ferraro as well, because it seemed like JEA is on the top ticket of all of these conservative Republicans to stop this man from privatizing it or selling it, whatever he's trying to do to it.
Thank you, Hank.
That's my comment.
Both Al Ferraro and Leanna Cumber, Republicans on the city council, did not make the runoff last night. Let me ask you one more question, Donna Deegan, before we turn to our analyst. Daniel Davis, a conservative Republican, is going to tell voters, most likely, that you're just too liberal for Jacksonville, that your priorities don't reflect the values of this city. He'll also point out that you campaigned alongside Andrew Gillum, who narrowly lost his election for governor to Ron DeSantis and then was later caught up in a sex scandal. What's your response to critics of your politics and your associations?
Well, listen, first of all, I would say that Daniel might be awful careful about making association comparisons. The GOP very often suffers from a serious lack of self-awareness when it comes to those things. But at the end of the day, I think people know me very well in this city. They've known me my whole life. I'm not some scary anything. I am Jacksonville. And I think that my views are very in line with most people in Jacksonville. I truly do. And I think people know that about me. So I think that is the standard line. You could take any ad that's written against a Democrat in anywhere in the country, and you can cut and paste what they're going to say in terms of you know, scary liberal. I hope people will tune in and hear what I'm actually saying. I have talked about wanting to fully fund our police department, making sure that we have enough officers on the streets. I've simply suggested that we need to also get underneath some of the causes of crime. So all those things they're going to say about me, are pretty much come with the soup. In terms of Andrew Gillum, look, as I've said many times, Andrew Gillum is my friend, and that is unconditional. I supported him because he wanted to fully fund education. He wanted to make sure that underserved folks had health care. I mean, he had some good priorities for Florida. He would not have tried to tear our public schools apart as we're seeing right now. So look, if he has done something that is against the law, then I suspect the law will take care of that. I'd like to see all of our politicians face the same scrutiny had they done something that's questionable. But at the end of the day, Andrew Gillum's not running for mayor of this city. I am. And I hope that people will judge me by my own merits. And I believe they will.
Donna Deegan, thanks for calling into the show this morning.
Thank you so much, Melissa. Have a great day.
All right. So we have a good field set now for the mayoral runoff, and let's talk about that and some other races on the ballot as we welcome A.G. Gankarski of Jax Today. Hi, A.G.
Hey, good morning, Melissa. How you doing?
Good, and we'll go to your calls, more of them coming in, and we'll go to them in just a bit at 549-2937. Okay, so your thoughts about this runoff?
Well, Deegan said last night she's a strong front runner. I look at it kind of Davis is where he wants to be. Yeah, he finished 15 points back, but I think the political operations that Deegan talked about in the interview just now are going to come in play. You're going to see Ron DeSantis in play here. You're going to see the Tim Baker, Aaron Isaac machine cutting her up with contrast ads after contrast ads. Just because Leanna Cumber is out of the race does not mean the negative ad stop. No, it means they recalibrate and target on Deegan. I looked at some precinct data last night, and, we talked about low turnout. That's the big cliche we keep saying, 25% turnout. Why aren't people voting? Well, it's only in certain places that they aren't voting, and those places are Democratic. Precinct 114 had turnout under 10%. Deegan won that one 2-1 over Davis. What would have happened if turnout had been 20%, 30% in that precinct? It would have been a little stronger. Look at 505. That's in Cumber City Council District. That had over 53% turnout. Deegan got all but 19 Democrats in that San Marco District. The Republicans were plus 400 there. 717, that's the Ortega precinct. Turnout was around 50%. Davis took 1,005 of 2,742 votes cast. So the turnout issue is a Democratic issue. It's not writ large. And that's something that feels like a hangover from the 2019 race where the Democrats didn't bother to field a candidate. You didn't see these problems when Alvin Brown was running in 2015. So these are recent problems. Deacon has been all over the city and has done the things she talked about at great length, but it doesn't seem to have turned around the turnout issues for Democrats. That's a warning sign. You know, like I expect the Republican Party of Florida to engage heavily. Christian Ziegler was in town yesterday doing Get Out the Vote turnout. He's a very aggressive new chair. He's looking to score victories against Nikki Fried. Ron DeSantis will definitely engage, especially given, you know, how much Deegan is talking about him. People like Nate Monroe speculated that, well, Davis and DeSantis aren't necessarily simpatico. You know, the Jacksonville Republican machine is too close to Susie Wiles, and DeSantis is going to play with that. But in the end, Ron DeSantis does not want to lose the Jacksonville mayor's office to an Andrew Gillum liberal, which is exactly how they're going to paint Donna Deegan. So expect the robocalls, expect the ads, expect the rallies, expect the full treatment. Also, looking at T.K. Waters, the Fraternal Order of Police, they are going to engage also. If you looked at the 2018 gubernatorial campaign when DeSantis was talking about Andrew Gillum being close to the Dream Defenders and all these other left-of-center groups, you'll see a replay of that. So while Deegan is well-known in Jacksonville and is broadly popular, that doesn't necessarily mean everything. If you look at the 2015 mayoral race, Lenny Curry was up against Alvin Brown. Alvin Brown, when he lost that race in May, was still at 55% popularity. It doesn't take completely knocking somebody out of the box, as they did to Leanna Cumber. It just takes creating that erosion of doubt. And I think that's what
By the way, not to cut you off, when you look at the cost per vote on the people that ran for mayor, it's remarkable. Al Ferraro, conservative Republican on the city council, wildly overperformed. He spent about $4 a vote. Leanna Cumber spent millions on this race, $81 a vote when you look at the analysis, and didn't even crack 10%. Just wanted to mention that. Hang on a minute, AG. Let's take a call. Brenda on the south side. Go ahead, Brenda.
Good morning, Melissa. I voted for Ms. Deegan, and I hope I can do it again. I just feel like even though she ended her segment, the last segment, very well, I don't feel like she was being specific towards the questions you were asking. And particularly, like, I work on the south side, live on the north side. So, you know, I'm traveling a significant distance through the city to get to work. And, you know, there's a lot of places around that the streets are trashy looking. There's sidewalks that abruptly end. Many of our exits or entrance ramps are dangerous. And she says she's going to fix the infrastructure. What's that mean? How? We want to know how. Are you going to hire more people? The city definitely needs more jobs. So tell us that.
Yeah, I think both candidates need to answer that question more fully. There will be another debate, I'm sure, a televised debate, where hopefully they will get that opportunity, Brenda. And, of course, we'll continue inviting them both on. Thank you for that. It's 549-2937. AG, let's talk about the city council races. Several of those are going to runoffs, some won outright. Your thoughts?
Interesting race, District 7. That's one that's definitely going to a runoff. Joseph Hogan and Jimmy Peluso are the top two finishers. John Phillips, he poured $250,000 into his campaign. To put that in perspective, he could have paid for an editor and three full-time staff writers for Folio Weekly for what he burned to this campaign. The problem with Phillips' strategy is he was playing to Springfield. He was playing to the urban core. The turnout was in Ortega. It was in Avondale. It was in Riverside to a lesser degree. That was Peluso and Hogan country. And when I look at that race, you basically see District 7, which was a minority access district. It's basically become an Ortega, Riverside, Avondale opportunity district, and I think Jimmy Peluso takes advantage of that in May. You look at large five, that's another one that's going to run off. You know, Chris Miller and Charles Garrison, Republican and Democrat respectively, emerged there. And I would guess, based on the fact he got 37% and he's got the cops endorsements, Chris Miller is going to be the guy who emerges there in the end. You know, Terrence Freeman, Ron Salem, they won their races, you know, handily, and they're basically elimination races. So both of them got reelected, the council president and vice president respectively. This paves a path for Ron Salem to be council president next year. So he will work with whoever the next mayor is, you know, Deegan or Davis, obviously. And those are the at-large races of interest. You know, one of the really interesting district races to me was District 5, was Republican versus Republican. Matt Carlucci versus Morgan Roberts, or sorry, Joe Carlucci versus Morgan Roberts, sorry. Joe Carlucci cleaned up in that race. He collected an impressive variety of endorsements from the social conservatives on the right, police and fire unions. He had a mailer with Ron DeSantis pictured by him, but you got one issue with Joe Carlucci, and that's his dad is on council. So basically, you've got the most glaring potential sunshine law violations to look at over the next 4 years. What happens when they get to issues where Matt Carlucci stands alone against the council, such as on a Confederate monument issue and things like that? You know, do Joe and Matt talk off outside of City Hall about it? What happens when Joe inevitably runs for council leadership in year three? You know, is Matt going to go through a prestige of a public notice meeting to pledge support the way that, you know, historically it's been done, or is it just going to be assumed? So you've got these questions into play. So those are some of the more interesting council races to me. It's also worth mentioning property appraiser. Joyce Morgan came very close to getting 50%, but she didn't close it out last night. She beat Jason Fisher by close to 15, 20 points, whatever the number was. But the problem is, you know, the Republican performance outshined Democratic performance last night. It was like R plus four plus. If we see that again in May, Jason Fisher is going to be a property appraiser. He's got more money, and he's got the DeSantis and T.K. Waters endorsement. You know, you might say, what does a property appraiser matter to the governor? Are millage rates woke? I mean, you know, what does property appraising have to do with law and order? Who knows? But these are issues that can be conflated and used to, you know, drive voters who are essentially low information voters against Morgan, who did not have much money in her campaign and who basically won based on name ID.
And, you know,
first based on that.
No. Yeah. Also, let's point this out. We've discussed it before on this show. Holding a mayoral and council election in an off-year cycle, not putting it in line with a major presidential cycle, say, that benefits the status quo in this city. It makes it harder for new faces, new candidates to break through. It makes it harder to bring about the kind of transformational change these candidates say Jacksonville needs. The establishment, the power elite in the city, have resisted calls to change the timing of these municipal elections. Critics say to maintain the status quo, AG.
Yeah, I mean, this is a recurrent discussion. I don't see any movement on it happening anytime soon. And I don't know if it's a really, I don't know if it's a useful discussion, honestly, because it's not an issue that's going to change. It's kind of like the old bowler's excuse shirt that people had in the 80s, where they'd have 101 reasons why they didn't get a strike. They slipped on the lanes, or they had a hangover or whatever. You know, it's kind of like this. I mean, you know, if you look at Democratic precincts and how they don't churn out, you look at Republican precincts and how they do churn out, I think the correlation there is ownership and equity stake. I mean, we have an increasing amount of renters in the city. If you're renting versus owning a house, you have less of a stake in where the city is. And, you know, you see voting that way. You look at, you know, where Al Ferreira's vote came from. A lot of it came from District 2. And those voters are motivated by issues of development and things like that that Ferreira was speaking to. So I think that the way you increase voter participation is you have more home ownership in the city, less people renting from hedge funds and out-of-state landlords and out-of-country landlords in some places. So I think that canard of let's move the elections, it fixes the problem for Democrats. I don't think that dog hunts, to quote Lawton Childs and Corrine Brown, whoever else used that.
And Lyndon Johnson. But I don't think it would necessarily fix
That's
the problem.
My time.
I don't think it would necessarily fix the problem for Democrats. But certainly predatory housing practices, that's another big issue that both of these candidates need to speak to, the affordable housing issue. Some of the candidates ran on that issue. Most of them that highlighted that as a key tenet of what they do on the city council didn't win. So that's something to think about. Almost out of time. What are your final thoughts about all of this?
My final thoughts are that Democrats need to engage on a state and national level. If they expect Donna Deegan to be able to flip this office, she's got to do what Alvin Brown did in 2015. Get help from the national and state party. Get help from donors across the aisle. Not across the aisle, but like, you know, above Duval level. She's run a Jacksonville centric campaign. That's great, but that's not everything that's in play there. She also needs to reach out to Al Ferrero and Leanna Cumber and bring them in. You know, Audrey Gibson also. I mean, my first call would have been to Audrey Gibson saying, hey, if I win, do you want to place my administration in a meaningful place in my administration, not one of these, Robin Lum sort of busy work jobs, but something where Audrey Gibson really has a stake seat at the table. Leanna Cumber, Al Ferrero, same deal. I would make those calls and I would build that team of rivals, because if you're running against establishment Republicanism, well, guess what? You've got two Republican candidates who lost that establishment Republican machine. And you've got Audrey Gibson, who brings a lot to the table, more political experience than anybody else in this race. And I think those are assets you can leverage if you're Donna Deegan. And if you don't, it's at your peril.
A.G. Gankarski of Jax Today. Thanks.
Thank you. Have a great day.
You too. Much more still ahead. Later in the hour, a little good news for your Wednesday. But up next, why today is National Hug a Farmer Day. That's after this. How about this, folks? Today is National Hug a Farmer Day. It's part of National Agriculture Week. And to celebrate, the Duval Soil and Water Conservation District and the Murray Hill Farmers Market are hosting a special Hug a Farmer Market. That sounds fun. Tiffany Bess is vice chair of Duval Soil and Water, and she's the program lead for Start Farming. Hey, Tiffany, good morning.
Hello, good morning. Thank you so much for having me on this morning.
You know, my granddad was a farmer, my uncle and my cousin are farmers. I have ties to some farmland in Illinois, so I love to hear about National Hug a Farmer Day. What is National Hug a Farmer Day?
Yeah, so it is just a day, it's a part of a full week to show our farmers and our ranchers and our forest workers that we care and that we appreciate all the hard work and dedication that they put into making sure our community is well fed and we have the resources that we need to live.
Okay, so to celebrate all of this and educate people about agriculture, you're having what sounds like a pretty cool event at the Murray Hill Farmers Market today. Tell us what's happening.
So it's going to be a spring market in partnership with the Murray Hill Farmers Market, which is at Fishware Brewing. It's twice monthly, every second and fourth Wednesday of the month. So we're going to have some farm-tastic activities, including a paper hug card-making station. So attendees can fill out the card with special notes for the farmers, and we'll make sure it gets to them. And then everyone is going to get to visit one of the farmers at the event. They'll get a stamp in their farm passport. They'll bring it back to our booth, and they'll get a prize. We have photo op opportunities, live music. The Murray Hill Farmers Market has waived the vendor fee for all the farmers to show them that they care. And then we're going to be giving a gift basket to all of the farmers there, too.
And you're also trying to encourage people to consider agriculture as a career. Is that right?
Definitely. Definitely. So definitely encouraging people to stop by our booth to learn about careers in agriculture and what the Duval Soil Water Conservation does for our community.
And let's talk about that, because people hear about this thing, the Duval Soil and Water Conservation District. And they say, what the heck is that?
Yeah.
What is it? Tell us what you do.
So the Duval Soil Water Conservation District is actually celebrating 70 years this year in July. So what we do is we help landowners and land users get the tools, the funding, the information needed to conserve resources on their property.
And what are some ways that you do that? What are some of the things that you educate and talk about?
We partner with the USDA and the NRCS and the NACD, a lot of acronyms, I'm sorry, to help them with the programs that they already have in place. So there's like the EQIP, which will help farmers get funding to, you know, put a bioswale on their property to help conserve water, to start implementing no-till practices and things like that. And then we do a lot of educational outreach. So since we are an urban county, we don't do the same things that a lot of the rural districts do, just because it's a different game. But we do a lot of educational outreach. So we have the Envirothon program, which works with high school students, and it's like an environmental brain brawl and speech and poster contests and the Start Farming Mentorship.
You know, it's such a big county, and it is an urban county, but a lot of people don't realize there are farms in Duval County. You can drive outside of town, not too far, and you're looking at some farmland, and it's still in Duval.
Definitely, definitely. That's the beautiful thing about, you know, the size of Duval is we really do have a little bit of everything in here. We have a huge timber production here. We have a lot of cattle as well. And we're really trying to encourage a lot more urban farming, too.
Now, Tiffany, just the other day, I watched a documentary on Netflix hosted by Woody Harrelson, the actor. It was called Kiss the Ground.
I love that documentary.
And it was fascinating. I learned a lot about how we're going to hopefully use planet Earth's soil to sequester carbon to combat the impacts of climate change. Tell us more about how that's going to work and your involvement in that.
Yeah, so soil is amazing, and that's definitely where my passion comes from. I have a composting business called Apple Rabbit Compost, and I'm really focused on helping enrich our soil, get to the nutrients, get what we need back into it where it belongs. So composting is able to help the soil by filling it up with organic matter, and it's really important.
Yeah, and Apple Rabbit, your composting business, is doing well, I hear. That's kind of cool, too. Anyway, let's give it a little plug.
Yeah, so Apple Rabbit Compost, we started in 2013. This is actually 7 years this month. We work with local residents and businesses to help give them a way to divert their food waste from the landfill. So we take it back to our compost site. It is community size scale. We do all the dirty work, and then we give the compost back to our subscribers or people in our community as well.
It helps plants grow like nothing else.
Oh, yes.
Yeah. So, you know, this is really cool because not only is today National Hug a Farmer Day, it's National Agriculture Week. This is a whole week to highlight the importance of the agriculture sector, which is a big part of Florida's economy, by the way. It's always seen as one of the three legs of our Florida economic stool, isn't it?
It is, yes. I mean, A lot of people don't even realize that, like, during the winter months, 100% of the green beans grown in the United States come from Florida.
So, I didn't know that.
Yeah, a huge crop of ours. And so farming, we have beautiful weather. And, you know, it's very comparable, you know, to California even. And California's kind of, you know, grows all of our food. And I think Florida's pretty close behind.
What are the other biggest crops Florida grows?
Citrus, of course.
Yeah, of course.
We got a lot of strawberries, too. We have perfect season for that. And
but as you said, cattle, bigger than people realize.
Yes.
In
and
Florida.
Timber, a lot of timber.
And timber. Too. So interesting. Okay. So with all of that said, Hug a Farmer Day means when you come out to the event at Fish Weir Brewing today at 4, you don't have to actually hug the farmers, although they probably would like that, right?
You don't have to, but stop by the card making station and make a little paper hug and give it to them.
Nice. You know, as we're sitting here talking about farmers, I have to tell you, I just am flashing back to memories of my grandfather. He looked like a farmer from the Dust Bowl era. He truly did. Every day of his life, he wore this beaten up old pair of blue denim overalls. I don't think I ever saw him wearing anything but that, except once in a very great while, if we went out to dinner somewhere, he'd put on a different outfit, like a nice outfit. But 99% of the time, he was farming in these overalls, and he was such an old school gentleman in so many ways. And farming techniques have changed so much since he was doing it. And I know a tiny bit about that only because of my relatives. But, you know, agriculture, the tradition of agriculture in this country is one that not enough Americans truly respect or understand, I think. That's the point I want to make when I think about my grandfather.
I agree.
You know?
I agree.
Is that what animates your work?
It is. It is. So, you know, the district itself started 70 years ago because of the Dust Bowl. And so I think that there's a lot of changing surrounding how we do agriculture. And we're definitely getting more into sustainability and regenerative practices. And we've learned that a lot of the things that we've done before, like tilling up our soil, isn't good for it.
Yeah.
You know, there's a whole ecosystem beneath our feet. And when we go through with blades and we chop it up, you know, we are destroying an ecosystem that's so important for us.
Yeah. I would encourage everyone to watch Kiss the Ground. I learned a lot about how it all works. And everyone, I would encourage you as well to come out today to Fish Weir Brewing Company at 1183 Edgewood Avenue South for Hug a Farmer Day. Come on out, learn more about agriculture, and there's a lot of fun stuff that will be happening there. Tiffany Bess, Vice Chair of the Duval Soil and Water Conservation District and the Program Lead for Start Farming. Thank you so much.
Thank you, and I would like to thank our presenting sponsors for this event, the St. John's River Keeper as well. Thank you so much.
And check out Apple Rabbit Compost too, folks. She'll come and do your composting for you. All right, when we come back, we will meet the 68-year-old Avondale woman who could soon become, this is really true, the Women's World Croquet Champion. I am not making this up. So keep listening. We'll be right back.
I'm Marco Werman. The world is full of stories.
Israel's never before been in a situation remotely like this.
So they put their hopes in China.
We have a massive aging population here in Europe.
When you arrive in Ghana, then you tell yourself, this is where I should be.
It's 1 hour each day when you get a global perspective. Join us on The World.
This afternoon at 3, here on WJCT News 89.9.
The Sweet 16 matchups are set, and for those of you who are cynical about college hoops, here's a different perspective.
Cohesiveness, continuity, unselfishness, toughness, the ability to overcome adversity, those are some of the things that I've observed in this great tournament so far.
How coaching and school culture can be the magic formula behind Cinderella teams on All Things Considered from NPR News.
This afternoon at 4, here on WJCT News 89.9.
I'm Deepa Fernandez. The co-hosts of NPR's Alt Latino join us for some spring music picks.
Spring kind of gets me in like a happy indie kind of mood, if you will.
More music for your spring playlists next time on Here and Now.
Today at 2 on WJCT News 89.9.
Next time on 1A, why did President Biden approve a major oil and gas drilling project in Alaska? Running as a candidate, Joe Biden promised there would be no more drilling on federal lands. We hear the arguments for and against the Willow Project, and we look inside the decision to greenlight what's been dubbed a carbon bomb.
Today, starting at 10 on WJCT News 89.9.
Welcome back. Well, she's a 68-year-old retired school teacher. And Helen Covington of Avondale has also been chosen to represent America later this year in the Women's World Golf Croquet Tournament. That's right. Covington is one of the top female croquet players in the world. She could come home as the world champ after this summer's competition in Sussex, England. Now, Helen told me she only took up the sport of croquet at the age of 60. That's proof that it's never too late to start something new. I talked to Helen Covington about croquet and the women's worlds. Hey, Helen, good to be with you. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Melissa. I'm happy to be here.
And first off, congratulations. How did you get selected to go to the tournament?
The top two women players in grade, they give you a D grade, which is you competing against other people. And I have been trading off between number one and number two with Cheryl Bromley for the last year and a half. And so we are the number one and two women players in the United States.
That is amazing. Now, you're going to be playing at the championship in England later this year, is that right?
Yeah, it's the Women's World Golf Croquet Championship at the Sussex County Croquet Court near Brighton.
Okay. And why do you love this sport? What do you like about croquet?
Well, it's just fun. Golf croquet is the social one where you're out there with three other people, and everybody hits the ball, and you walk around the court, and you just laugh a lot. And it's been a real good, I call it my silver sport, because I started playing later in life. And it just is fun. You walk around hitting a ball through a hoop and hitting other people. It's just fun.
How'd you get good at it? Good enough to be a world champ?
Well, a group of us started together. The Florida Yacht Club built two courts in 2015. And John Currington, who's local, who's a Hall of Fame croquet player, came out to give us lessons. And he just told us the grips, told us to go out and just have fun. And a group of us started together, and we started getting better together, and we just had a great time. And then we started a little local league here in Jacksonville with five clubs between Jekyll Island and Hammock Dunes. And we just started meeting more and more people and playing more games, and it just blossomed from there.
Wow. Any tips for people that want to learn the game?
Come out and try it. You'll love it. It's like shooting pool. It's the same idea, round balls in pockets, but the mallets between your feet. It's great for any age. I play people in their 80s and 90s who are still really good at the game. And it's a great, you walk around, you're outdoors. It's just a lovely, lovely sport.
Good luck, Helen Covington. Bring us home that championship trophy. All right, more good news. Harbinger Sign in Jacksonville is celebrating its 60th anniversary this month. A new exhibition opening at the Florida Mining Gallery with live music, food, and drinks. This is April 1st, 6:30 p.m. at their headquarters at 5300 Shad Road. The Epilepsy Alliance of Florida hosts its annual Walk the Talk for Epilepsy in Jax. This is coming up Saturday in front of Village Bread Cafe on River Place Boulevard on the South Bank. Registration starts at 8 a.m. and the walk at 9:15. Check it out at epilepsyalliancefl.org. Last but not least, the Amelia Island Dance Series with Crescendo Amelia is back Sunday. Each event in the series features a 14-piece big band with themes ranging from swinging to spring to Havana nights and even a masquerade ball. Info and tickets at crescendoamelia.com. And before we say goodbye, our own station manager David Luckin is here now to not talk about music, but about public radio and supporting nonprofit news.
It's time to show your support for this program. And the good news today is we'll double or triple your investment.
Triple?
Our board. Well, if you're a new sustainer, we're going to take your $1 and we're going to add two to it. So that's a triple.
Wow.
If you're existing and you just want to do a one time or up it, we'll match you one for one. So it's thanks to our board of our executive board for coming up with that money out of their own pockets.
Nice.
To give us, to induce you to give us a call so we can double or triple your investment. Do it now. Call us at 353-9528. It's never been more important. The news has never been more interesting than right now. So if you're a news junkie like some of us are who work in this business, of course, you know what I'm talking about. You can't keep up. You can also text news899 to the number 44321.
Yeah, make your donation right through your phone.
Or go online at wjct.org/radio.
That's right. Text news899 to the number 44321, and you can just donate to public radio that quickly. And, you know, if you sustain us at 10 bucks a month, if you commit to that, we'll send you a t-shirt. It's a pretty cool t-shirt, by the way.
And we've got a great cap also, and we've got an HD converter. So if your car doesn't have HD radio, this little converter will turn your car into a smarter car, and you'll get to listen to
it. I need one of those.
I'll give you one. I got one in the studio.
Because I want to listen to our HD channel, music channels, and my car is old, so I can't.
We're gonna freshen your car as soon as we get off the air. We're going to go out in the parking lot and get you one. And you need one too, you listeners out there. You need to give us a call, 353-9528. Do what you can, $5 or $500. It all goes into the programming fund, and we thank you so much for your support.
Call us up or text news899 to the number 44321 and support nonprofit news and public radio. Thanks, David, and thanks, everyone. We'll be back again tomorrow at 9 a.m. Make it a great day.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.